On October 24th, 1964, the former British colony of Northern Rhodesia, located in Southern Africa, attained its independence, renaming itself Zambia, after the Zambezi River. After a 20-year, sometimes violent national struggle, a British Act of Parliament granted Northern Rhodesia the right to hold free and fair elections in 1962, which to nobody's surprise were won decisively by Zambian nationalists, beginning a transition to independence. The process culminated in a ceremony in the capital, Lusaka, on October 24th, in which the newly elected president of Zambia, a former freedom fighter named Kenneth Kaunda, was sworn in, the Union Jack was lowered and the Zambian flag raised, and a band played the new Zambian national anthem in front of an audience of thousands. One thing the ceremony did not include, much to the dismay of another prominent Zambian freedom fighter, Edward Makuka Nkloso, was the launch of a manned, Zambian-made rocket to Mars. I'm your host, Tor Parsons, this is my co-host, Jolly B. the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. One of the most positive legacies of the Cold War was, of course, the space race. In 1957, as Zambia inched closer to independence, the first human-made object in space, the beach ball-sized Russian probe Sputnik 1, circled the Earth for 3 months. A month after the launch of Sputnik 1, the dog Laika went to space aboard Sputnik 2. While Laika is commonly cited as the first living thing in space, she realistically had to settle for a ranking somewhere in the first few billion because of all the bacteria that were undoubtedly carried on Sputnik 1. Then, in 1961, Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space aboard Vostok 1, though not before starting the enduring Russian cosmonaut ritual of peeing on the back right tire of the bus that took him to the launch pad. Understandably, the early Soviet successes in space strengthened America's resolve to join them, and after briefly considering shooting a nuclear bomb at the moon, creating an explosion and crater that they hoped would be visible from Earth, they decided instead to aim to land a person on the moon. But at the same time, a third country was considering getting in on the space race in the Third World. The phrase Third World, today considered a dated, somewhat politically incorrect term for poor countries, originated around this time, referring not to national income, but national alliances. There were states aligned with the US, states aligned with the USSR, and the rest, which were called the Third World. Many of these countries were emerging from centuries of Western colonialism, and they began to form their own bloc, the Non-Aligned Movement, aiming to challenge the supremacy of both the Western and Eastern blocs. When the Non-Aligned Movement was officially established as an alliance in 1961 by the leaders of India, Egypt, Indonesia, Ghana, and Yugoslavia, the Third World was no longer just the other countries, the leftover ones that didn't take sides in the Cold War. It was a unified entity of its own. This is what spurred Edward Makuka Nkloso, one of the leaders of the Zambian resistance movement, to start the Zambian National Academy of Science, Space Research, and Philosophy around 1960. Zambia wasn't yet independent at this point, but everyone could tell the winds of change were blowing that way, and as Nkloso described later in many a surreal interview, he figured that if the commies were going to space and the Yankees were going to space, it was high time the non-aligned countries got a piece of the space pie too. He had ambitions of representing the entire young continent of Africa, shaking off the shackles of colonialism with his space program, which is reflected in the name Nkloso gave to the 12 trainees who had signed up to go to space with him. America called them astronauts, Russia called them cosmonauts. In Zambia, Nkloso decided, they would be called Afronauts. Without the support of the government, and little money or formal education to his name, Nkloso did what he could to train his prospective astronauts for the journey. The most experience he'd had with space before then was having been on a plane when he was young, a very rare experience for Africans at the time, a memory that he carried throughout his life. Nkloso started a rigorous boot camp. He had the astronauts practice dealing with weightlessness by putting them in metal oil drums and rolling them downhill. Free fall preparation was accomplished by having the astronauts swing on ropes from trees, then cutting the rope at the height of the swing's arc. He dropped them out of trees into ponds, once again in oil drums, to simulate water landings. For reasons never fully explained, Nkloso believed that the only way people would be able to walk on the moon would be on their hands. So, he trained everyone to walk around on their hands. But life at the Zambian National Academy wasn't all work and no play. Nkloso told one of the increasing numbers of curious Western news agencies who had shown up to interview him that when the astronauts were not training to go to space, they played gigs as the Dynamite Rock Music Group. They even had green satin jackets made expressly for this purpose, while Nkloso himself strutted around in a military helmet and a long velvet cape. But of course, having a crew that can swing on ropes, rock out, and walk on their hands won't get you into space on its own. For that, you need a rocket. So, Nkloso began building a rocket. Skeptical news footage of the Zambian Space Academy shows a cylindrical object, 3 meters tall by about a meter in diameter, probably welded together out of more of Nkloso's beloved oil drums. This, he says, is what will take Zambians into space. It doesn't look big enough to fit more than one person, and given that it would need to include rocket engines and a fair amount of fuel, it barely looked like one person could fit. Several news sources assert that the name of the rocket was Dikalo 1, which was apparently explained as a reference to President Kenneth Kaunda, a close friend of Nkloso in the Zambian resistance movement. But the Zambian author Namwali Serpell, who wrote a novel that included Nkloso as a minor character, suggested an alternate etymology. She believes that the rocket was meant to be named after Kalulu, a rabbit in Zambian folktales who causes trouble for the elephant and the lion, who are perpetually locked in a struggle for king of the animals. The symbolism should be obvious. If the USSR wanted to defend their early dominance of the space race, and the US wanted to land a man on the moon, Zambia's goals, or shall we say, Nkloso's goals, as he never got the support he expected from the Zambian government, were all that and more. After initially announcing lunar ambitions like the two great powers, Nkloso decided to go further, saying Zambians, quote, are to become controllers of the seventh heaven of interstellar space. He set his sights on reaching Mars. By 1964, with Zambian independence looming, Nkloso and his astronauts felt that they were ready. He began writing editorials in Zambian newspapers in which he announced that Zambia was 6 or 7 years ahead of the great powers in scientific research, and that he was constantly having to apprehend American and Soviet spies who were attempting to steal his secrets. The astronauts had made strange, distinctive spacesuits for themselves, which looked to me like the hazmat suits from Monsters, Inc. Nkloso announced that on October 24th, Independence Day, he would launch Dikalo 1 from the middle of Lusaka to Mars, a journey he said would only take a few days. Naturally, not all of the 13 people involved in the Zambian space program, Nkloso and his 12 trainees, were going to be on board. With the other components of the mission, which I'll get to in a second, Dikalo 1 could only fit one smaller-than-average person. So, Nkloso decided that the first African in space and first person on Mars would be Mata Mwambwa, the youngest astronaut, a 16-year-old self-described space girl. She became the public face of the space program and something of a Zambian national hero, though many Zambians, including Mata's parents, weren't sure what to make of the whole scheme. Mata was not going to be alone on the mission, though. The rocket was also going to carry 2 cats, who had been selected from a litter of 12 bred at the Zambian Space Academy for this exact purpose. The 2 cats who were chosen for the mission had undergone, quote, special training, though what that entailed is lost to history. Why were their cats being brought along? Well, on the way, they were supposed to keep Mata company. Once the Dikalo 1 arrived on Mars, though, they had a much more important job, to serve as canaries in a proverbial coal mine. The cats would be released from the craft first, and if they survived, Mars was safe for human habitation. If they didn't, it's not clear what would have happened. Was Dikalo 1 supposed to be reusable? Even the Americans didn't have reusable rockets back then. In fact, the Apollo astronauts weren't sure they would successfully be able to get back from the moon. Given what we've already learned about Nkloso, I can picture Mata asking him how she would get back from Mars and him responding, "You can cross that bridge when you come to it. It probably won't be that hard." Nkloso's friend Kenneth Kaunda, about to be sworn in as president of Zambia, nixed Nkloso's suggestion to make the launch of Dikalo 1 the centerpiece of Zambia's independence celebrations. Kaunda was aware the Zambian Space Academy was already becoming a laughingstock in the Western press, and he was afraid that if Nkloso did try to shoot off any rockets during the independence celebration, it would end badly. The Independence Celebrations Committee said that it would, quote, "terrify the guests and possibly the whole population." Nkloso denied there was any chance of it going wrong. But Mata Mwamba was aware of the dangers of spaceflight and said that she was a bit nervous. They backed down from their plans of an imminent launch. If Nkloso was demoralized by his loss of support from the Zambian government, many of whom he'd fought alongside in Zambia's independence struggles, he didn't let it show. 1 week after independence, he could be found once again back at the Zambian Space Academy, showing off his rocket to a reporter from Reuters News, and leading the astronauts in rounds of calisthenics. Nkloso decided that he was going to need a bigger rocket, and for that, he needed money. Finally, in possibly the first realistic thought to cross his mind, he estimated it would cost him $2 billion to get to the moon, and far more to get to Mars. The total Apollo project cost $25.8 billion in 1960s dollars, but that consisted of several missions with a team of thousands. It's conceivable that someone far better versed in physics and engineering than Nkloso, working in a cheap country like Zambia with other extremely smart people, could have made it to the moon in the 60s on a budget of $2 billion. So, what did Nkloso do with this seemingly newfound awareness of the scope of his project? He asked UNESCO for a grant of 7 million Zambian pounds. This would allow him to build a better rocket, he assumed, and once he had that as a demonstration of progress, he'd be able to raise the rest from donors in the US, the USSR, and the non-aligned world. His Martian ambitions expanded. This time he wanted to send not just Mata and the cats, but his own dog, Cyclops. Because if the Russians sent a dog to space, so should he. The new rocket was to be named Cyclops 1, after the dog, and Nkloso considered launching it with a catapult-like structure. He also planned to send a Christian missionary on the Mars mission. Who this was planned to be was unclear. Were they supposed to be one of the other astronauts, or would a trained missionary be brought into the program? I'm not sure. And why a missionary in the first place? Because, see, building rockets and training astronauts weren't the only things Nkloso was doing at the Zambian Space Academy, which he was now calling his secret headquarters, despite freely giving out its location to anyone who cared to stop by and have a look. He also claimed to be studying the Moon and Mars through high-powered telescopes, the sort that only Zambia was technologically advanced enough to have access to. Nkloso said, "We are now certain Mars is populated by primitive natives." Bringing Christianity to the Martians was going to be one of the main purposes of the Mars mission. However, he, quote, "warned the missionary he must not force Christianity on the people in Mars if they do not want it." UNESCO never got back to him. Nor did any of the other groups Nkloso asked for funds. Not Israel, not India, nor, finally in desperation, his enemies in the space race, the US and USSR. The biggest grant he ever got was a 10-rupee note, equivalent to 13 cents today, and probably less then, from a space-obsessed student in India. And now he was having to combat delinquency among his astronauts. He'd previously lamented that they spent too much time making love and not enough time studying the moon. His words, not mine. And now, as the planned launch date for Cyclops 1 became further and further off, the astronauts began to disappear from the academy for longer and longer periods. They went off on drinking sprees, and sometimes were found off in distant villages practicing traditional Zambian song and dance instead of studying up on how to survive Mars and evangelize the Martians. Mata, his standard-bearer astronaut, became pregnant, after which her parents removed her from the space program, worried she'd get blown up or something. And the construction progress on Cyclops 1 hit a stumbling block when, according to Nkloso, the rocket was sabotaged by foreign agents, which I'm sure is exactly what happened. At one point, he ranted that the Zambian government had destroyed the former building of the Zambian Space Academy. Though why, what this was a dispute over, and even whether this really happened is unclear.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running.
And then, in 1969, the U.S. won the space race, where Nkloso had long hoped to plant the Zambian flag on a pit stop on the way to Mars. The Stars and Stripes now stood frozen, unmoving, in the vacuum of space. That was the last straw for Edward Makuka Nkloso. While he personally still had dreams of reaching the stars, after all, the Americans still hadn't conquered Mars, leaving that as a potential prize for Zambia, the remaining astronauts' morale was broken, and they deserted him. The Zambian National Academy of Science, Space Research, and Philosophy was closed. Nkloso was still a nationally known figure, with plenty of friends in high places among the Zambian political class, and in 1971, he ran for mayor of Lusaka on a platform of rapid technological development. His campaign platform said things like, "Matero, Kamwala, and Chilenje suburbs will quickly be filled with flats and skyscrapers. The capital city of Zambia will quickly become another Paris, if not another New York. And people from afar must not see a slum as the capital of the world's greatest scientific state." He lost. President Kaunda appointed him head of the Liberation Center, which focused on supporting anti-colonial struggles elsewhere in Africa. Some accounts describe the Liberation Center basically as a sinecure, something Kaunda offered to his friend to keep him occupied and satisfied so he didn't get into any more harebrained schemes like the space program. Others say this position is crucial to understanding the full story of Edward Nkloso. So, I'm sure by now you've got questions. In particular, I'm sure you've got one burning question: was Nkloso serious? And here's where the plot thickens. Now that the Zambian space program has been satisfactorily introduced, I'll say this. This is one of the thorniest subjects I'll ever cover on Tor's Cabinet. While I've done plenty of episodes about mysteries, I think this is the first, and possibly only, in which the mystery is epistemological. There's controversy over exactly what the subject I'm covering was. I am, of course, covering the Zambian space program, but what was the Zambian space program? An earnest attempt at reaching the stars and proving the worth of the developing world during the space race? A hilarious comedy of errors? A totemic expression of national pride aimed at lifting ordinary Zambian spirits in the wake of independence with no real intentions of ever reaching escape velocity? A hoax the Western media fell for? I think Edward Nkloso's Zambian Space Academy is best read as a sort of Rorschach test. How serious you think it was says something about your perception of Africa. Paternalistic right-wing elements, like the departing British at the time, saw it as a serious project and laughed. Moving forward through history, you get to people who believe it was all a brilliant hoax, making fun of the ridiculousness of the Cold War space race, a tribute to the apparent Zambian penchant for sarcasm. The deeper you go down the rabbit hole, things don't get any clearer as to what Edward Nkloso and his astronauts truly intended. Of course, even while the space program was going on, many believed it to be a joke. When rank-and-file Zambians were asked about what they thought about Nkloso, they often responded with comments along the lines of, "Why does he want to go to space? Why would anyone want to go to space? Isn't that a waste of money?" In fact, even in America, the space program was controversial for that reason.
Poem said, "A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon, and her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon."
This is by Gil Scott Heron, sometimes credited as the first rapper, and he wrote this in 1970 in New York. I doubt he'd ever heard of Edward Nkloso, but many people thought Nkloso was expressing the exact same view. Both inside and outside Zambia, people observing Nkloso's ridiculous attempts at sending Zambians to space interpret it as a massive satirical project making fun of those whiteys on the moon. "Look at how ridiculous and stupid our project is," Nkloso seemed to be saying. "Look at how paranoid I am about spies and foreign elements. Look at how grandiose my goals are. Are the great power rivalries over who controls space any less ridiculous?" In fact, some people laughed at the credulity of the Western media, saying that obviously the whole thing was a prank, and the white world swallowed the bait because it fit their patronizing idea of Africans. A Zambian artist observed that Zambians, quote, don't have a yes or no. We have two yeses, and one of them means no. The space project fit perfectly into Zambians' sarcastic sense of humor. A Zambian government minister told the Chicago Journalism Review that everyone in Zambia understood Nkloso's project to be a joke, comparing him to the then-contemporary American comedian Pat Paulson, who regularly ran satirical campaigns for president, and saying, Mr. Nkloso is actually a very well-read person. And this is an awfully compelling interpretation. Nkloso's vision of Mars as a place populated by primitive natives who needed Christianity brought to them definitely reads as a caricature of British colonialism, and by naming that as a priority of his facetious space program, he was implying that now the Western powers were losing their colonies and turning their colonial ambitions to space. But is that really what was going through Nkloso's head? The space program wasn't some brief flash in the pan or a Potemkin front set up to deceive Western reporters. He really was training people and building what he said were rockets for several years. And private correspondences have been discovered between Nkloso and members of the Zambian government in which Nkloso stays in character, seemingly trying to convince people of the legitimacy of his space program. A letter has surfaced where Nkloso thanks Kaunda for getting him an invitation to watch the April 1972 launch of Apollo 16 in Florida, indicating that at the very least Nkloso did have a clear interest in space, even though there's no evidence beside that letter that Nkloso really was invited to the launch of Apollo 16. In order to unravel the true motive behind the Zambian space program, we need to take a dive into the life of Edward Makuka Nkloso. Now, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Much of the following story comes from the research of the aforementioned Namwali Serpell, a brilliant author who uncovered a lot about Nkloso in a 2017 article in The New Yorker. She had access to resources I'll never have, like family members in Zambia. So for this section of the episode, I'd just like to give her a fair amount of the credit. Read her novel, The Old Drift. Other people's accounts of Nkloso's life often start, and sometimes end, with one key event. His ride on an airplane, at a time when most Africans had never done such a thing, when he was in his 20s. In the tellings of Nkloso's life that aim to depict him as being serious about the space program, this is his apple on the head, Archimedes in the bath, new slang by the shins changed my life moment. One source I found claimed that when he was on the plane, he asked the pilot to stop so that he could walk around on some clouds. But few sources mention where that plane was taking him and why. He was being flown to Europe so that he could fight in World War II. Britain had told him that if he and thousands of other Zambians fought in the war, they would grant Zambia independence when the war was over. No prizes for guessing that when Nkloso finally returned to his home country, this proved to be an empty promise. He had been interested in science and engineering while working on communications technology during the war, and he planned to open a school back home in Zambia to teach the little he knew about science to Zambians. The colonial authorities didn't give him a permit. He opened the school anyway. Through the ensuing decades, Nkloso taught science at various secondary schools across Zambia, occasionally leading the staff in protests, which once again put him in the crosshairs of the colonial authorities. When teaching became too risky, Nkloso sold pharmaceuticals in Zambia's copper mining country, and no, this isn't a euphemism, he actually was employed by a pharmaceutical company going door to door. He got deeper into activism while he was in the copper belt, too, becoming exposed to Marxist ideas, and in 1955, presented the government of the copper mining city of Ndola with a surprisingly realistic set of demands, given that this guy later claimed he built a Mars rocket all by himself. He wanted the white authorities in Ndola to build a maternity clinic, a racially integrated school, and a technical college for Africans to learn specialized trades. Nkloso didn't get his way. But these were the sort of things anti-colonial activists the world over were demanding. If he ever was as weird as the West thought he was, he certainly wasn't weird yet. In a general crackdown on activists in Ndola in 1956, Nkloso was exiled back to his home village, where his activism would become more intense, but also occasionally take on a humorous tone, perhaps indicating the directions he'd end up going. He grew out his hair, in imitation of Jesus, who never cut his hair while he was preaching, and who he saw first and foremost as a fellow anti-colonial leader. But having long hair also allowed him to dress up as a woman to fool authorities. Followers remember seeing him, in drag, going up to colonial officers and saying things like, "Have you heard of the dangerous freedom fighter Edward Nkloso?" To which they'd respond, "Oh, yes, yes," and then he'd say, "Well, I heard he was spotted just a few villages over from here last week." This is a pretty clear bridge between Nkloso's activism and his satirical space program. Once again, if you believe it was satirical. In 1957, disaster struck Nkloso and his movement. Accused of starting a general strike, he was arrested after a 6-day manhunt. British colonial authorities, as well as black soldiers, beat him and many of his supporters nearly to death. Kenneth Kaunda, who was at this time in Britain directing the rebellion from afar, learned of the attack on his friend and publicized it to gain support for Zambian independence. Many people who knew Nkloso say that he wasn't quite the same after this moment, and suggest that he became weirder because of brain injuries sustained in the beating. Perhaps there's actually a really sad story behind the Zambian space program. Maybe it wasn't a hilarious hoax at the expense of the West, or an inspiring, if misguided, attempt at reaching the stars from the heart of Africa. Maybe it was the ravings of a once great leader reduced to madness. Or maybe it was something more interesting. Nkloso's son, Edward Makuka Nkloso Jr., suggested that the space program was both a hoax and a serious project. When Zambia attained its independence, Africa's struggle against colonialism wasn't over. Many neighboring countries didn't attain their independence until the mid-70s. Zimbabwe, then known as Rhodesia, was independent, but under the control of a white minority until 1980. The same was true of South Africa and Namibia until 1991. Zambia, a relatively stable and democratic country amid the chaos of southern Africa, was a funder of anti-colonial movements in other African countries. Nkloso Jr. speculates that even though the Zambian space program was referred to both in public and in private as a space program, the so-called Afronauts being trained knew exactly where they were being trained to go, and it wasn't space. All the oil drum rolling and calisthenics and hand walking were really strength and agility exercises to train new generations of freedom fighters in the rest of Africa. This is compelling. This is really compelling. It fits with Nkloso's post-space program appointment as head of Zambia's Liberation Center, and clearly all the bluster about going to Mars was intended as misdirection, so that the West would see him as a harmless curiosity. There's that mysterious letter in which Nkloso thanks Kaunda for getting him invited to the Apollo 16 launch, even though Nkloso almost definitely wasn't at the launch, and probably never even left Zambia after he came home from the war. Could the Apollo 16 launch be code for something happening closer to home? And yet, this fascinating explanation doesn't quite cover all the bases either. What's the deal with Mata Mbwambwa and the 12 cats and the rock band the Afronauts apparently formed? Are we just going to assume those were parts of building the space program's mystique, making them seem as out there as possible? And how about Nkloso's run for mayor of Lusaka, which he was both seemingly quite serious about and had a completely bonkers platform for? I have a hard time fitting that into the narrative of the Zambian space program as a brazen attempt at hiding a training camp for revolutionaries in plain sight. And why didn't the central Zambian government support the quote-unquote space program at all, given that if they really were training guerrillas for other African conflicts, this is something Kaunda would have supported. Why was there apparently conflict between Kaunda and Nkloso over the program?
0 minus 23 minuten. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
There was, once, a serious and fairly successful space program in Africa. It was run by a German firm from 1977 to 79, and privately supported by Mobutu Sese Seko, the dictator of Zaire, the country now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It used fairly distinctive and unusual designs for rockets, and while the primary use of the rockets was intended to be as weapons, to prop up Sese Seko's brutal military regime, there was also an ethos quite similar to some of Edward Nkloso's cooler-headed justifications for the Zambian space program. To show that space belongs to the developing world, too, and that space can be reached on a shoestring budget. The OTRAG rockets, a German acronym, were far cheaper than American or Soviet-built rockets and worked reasonably well. However, when the German government learned that a private company from their country was helping a brutal African dictatorship shoot off rockets, which may have violated clauses in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty against the militarization of space, they weren't all that happy, and France and the USSR joined an odd bedfellows partnership to shut down Zaire's space program before they managed to launch the first true Afronaut. It's hard to say whether this was a good thing or not. While obviously Mobutu Sese Seko should not have had access to state-of-the-art space technology, if the OTRAG rockets had been launched from some less repressive country, they may have successfully shown the world that spaceflight doesn't have to be a billion-dollar undertaking, and inspired space programs across the developing world. We all dream of space. I don't think it's particularly surprising that nearly all the world's richest people today are funding private space companies. We're in the midst of a new space race, this time between individuals instead of nations. If you were rich enough to go to space, of course you'd go to space. Who wouldn't? Maybe the answer is Edward Nkloso wouldn't. Maybe the answer is Gil Scott-Heron wouldn't. Maybe space really is just a Western fascination after all, just a status symbol. But I don't think that should be a takeaway from the twisty, damn near inscrutable tale of the Zambian space program. Whether or not he was serious, Nkloso was defining Africa in a way we don't usually think about it, even within Africa. That's the last theory for what Nkloso was really thinking as he trained his Afronauts. And it's probably my favorite. He was sending a message to Africa to dream big. He knew he'd never get off the ground. He knew there weren't really American and Soviet spies creeping around trying to pilfer Zambian technology. But in telling the world that there were, he was celebrating Zambian independence and the general decline of colonialism in a unique way. Look, he was saying, this is what we can do now that we're independent. Zambia may not really reach Mars tomorrow, but we may reach Mars next century. Africa has a role to play in the future, he was saying. We are all Afronauts. And yes, I can imagine Nkloso saying, yes, Africa has problems, our institutions are shaky, our living standards lower than the West. We're not training astronauts in a centrifuge, we're training them in an oil drum rolling down a hill. But we're training astronauts, he would say. Someday, even Africa will touch the stars. Nkloso has been named as one of the biggest inspirations for Afrofuturism, which is both a sci-fi subgenre and a sort of mindset, which takes traditionally futuristic ideas and places them in an Afrocentric setting. A juxtaposition, some people might call it, between technological progress and a continent often looked down on as backward. But it's not a juxtaposition. Even if the Zambian space program was satirical, the need to explore is human, not Western. We're one of the few species that has lived on nearly every continent, every landmass, on this entire planet, and the only other such species, like rats, got there by hitching rides on our boats. It's been a theme throughout human history. We decide to head off in a direction in which nobody is quite sure we'll find anything at all, just because there's something unexplored out there, and it's calling to us. Sometimes we fail, but sometimes we discover something. That's why we all want to go to space. And whether you're from Zambia, Zhanjiang, or Zanesville, Ohio, that's universal. And I think, all other things being equal, most of us would like to bring two cats along.